Good morning, Ms. Wright, and I want to thank you again. This is the second time you've come in less than a month at 8:30. Thank all the council for accommodating our schedule. Go ahead.
Good morning. May I please have the floor? Lisa Wright representing Mr. McCallum. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The court below ruled that retrial here will not violate Mr. McCallum's double jeopardy right to a verdict from his first jury, but the district court below applied the wrong legal standard. The court reasoned that because Mr. McCallum had moved for a mistrial, retrial wasn't barred unless the government had goaded him into making that request, citing Oregon v. Kennedy. But in these...
Wait, what's an example of a prosecutor goading a defendant into seeking a mistrial? What's that mean?
Well, it's a question of subjective intent. I mean, why someone would do that, I guess if the case is going badly.
Or do you know of any cases where that's happened?
Where a goading finding's been made? I don't.
Okay.
But I don't know. I assume... It's certainly possible that someone would want to do that and then would be found to have done that in order to avert the trial.
And let me ask you another question, just sort of background. Other than a hung jury, are there examples of manifest necessity? I mean, that's the ultimate example. What any other examples of a manifest necessity of a mistrial?
You know, people getting sick. I mean, you know, any sort of kind of unavoidable problem that's occurred that through no fault... a tainting of the jury somehow. But in these unusual circumstances, and neither side has found any case that's like this case, the rationale for this...
Well, in fact, you haven't found any cases that support your argument, have you?
This case is unique. I mean, this is a case where we have sort of the known and the unknown disclosure problem or violation. And, you know, obviously when there's just an unknown violation, the defendant doesn't move for a mistrial, so this isn't no problem. And in the case that the court...
Well, certainly there have got to be fact patterns. That this can't be that unusual a fact pattern, right, where information comes out later that the defense counsel thought might have been helpful to them in the original trial?
Well, yes, but not where there's also been the violation that they knew about and then made the Hobson's choice to ask for the mistrial. I mean, that's unusual. To have the known violation that then leads to the request for the mistrial and then finding out later.
And your problem is that the language of Kennedy seems pretty categorical, doesn't it? I mean, and so you have to argue that Kennedy didn't have this in mind?
They did not have this in mind. They weren't contemplating this. They were talking about where the conduct, I believe the phrase is, you know, where the conduct giving rise to the successful motion for a mistrial was intended to go. That's what.
So we have this one exception to the Kennedy rule, where a defense counsel has been goaded into seeking a mistrial. Might there be any similarity between? I'm not certain what principles that's vindicating, but might there be a similarity between that principle and the principle you're trying to vindicate here, the sort of lack of informed. Decision making? Is there something between the two that might be similar?
There's manipulation going on in the goading, I guess, that the defendant thinks it's their choice, but it's really not because they've been goaded. Mm-hmm. And here the defendant thinks they're in control, but they're not because they don't understand what their choices are. Mm-hmm.
Is that completely accurate here? I mean, defense counsel knew. Right, that there was a possibility that these complaints were out there. She didn't know what the complaints were, didn't get them till the day before retrial, but she knew they were out there. So the Hobson's choice you're talking about, it's not as if she was completely unaware that there might be something out there.
She didn't know there was anything out there that could be responsive because the government had been ordered to confirm that there was nothing else. And several days later, when crosses...
And they hadn't heard back, so there's... It's a live possibility.
Well, but
and she knew that there had been at least one complaint, right? I mean, the complaint raised by Mr. McCallum.
Right, but that doesn't say anything about whether there would be others. And I mean, the time for finding this was before Cross was over. Frankly, before Cross began was the time. So once Cross begins and nothing and the...
Well, why couldn't she have said it at trial, look, I'm interested in mistrial, but I really want to know, turn to the prosecutor, what's the deal on the complaints? Give me more information about the complaints.
Well, the complaints...
She could have done that, right? Well, she could have pressed that issue at that time, right?
He was under an obligation to come forward, right. You know, if there were. I mean...
Right.
And I mean, also, he was... The court had already had a stack of papers in front of it, and including some things that seemed to have, that he said were sort of some OPC documents. The court had said there was nothing in there that was producible except for this Jenks material at the back of the stack. So, I mean, he's under an order to do it. She doesn't know one way or the other whether he's looked at it himself and said, well, this stuff's just the same as, whether there's either nothing, whether he looks at it and says, this is the same as the court has already found isn't producible, because he wasn't ordered to give it to the judge ex parte. He volunteered that and said, look, I'm going to let the court make the decision here.
But to me, that sort of undercuts your, I think, a very interesting argument that I need to think more about, uh-huh. That the premise of Kennedy is that there's an informed consent. Even if there's an informed decision that's requisite to finding the rule in Kennedy here, it's undercut by the fact that she knew that this stuff might be out there. Well, she knew there was some stuff out there, and there might be more.
Well, but she already knew, but that's why the court...
I mean, she certainly made an informed, deliberate decision that I'm going to proceed with mistrial knowing that there might be more stuff out there.
The government never argued that. That's something they've come up with now, and I will say that when this was litigated below, the prosecutor never said, well, she knew that there was that was an open question. So I question the premise there. But the important thing is that I lost my train of thought. I will come back to that. Okay. But I did want to say on the bigger point about the Supreme Court's test and what the court was asking about there, that the key phrase, I think, in Dinitz is actually when you're talking about what's the importance of the knowingness and all that. In Dinitz, the court said that, you know, you're making this Hobson's choice between, continuing your trial tainted by prejudicial error or giving up your right to the first jury, and that the important thing is the defendant retained primary control over the course to be followed in the event of such error. So the court's whole premise is that the defendant knows of the error.
Yeah, and it's control.
And has control over choosing the lesser of the two evils as a result of that error. You know, that's what he has, and obviously he knows about it, and it's a bad situation. The court is acknowledging the defendant's in a bad situation. This bad thing has happened. Now he can't have all his rights. He's got to choose. But here he doesn't even know what he's choosing, and there is a big difference between the choice he made and the choice he thought he was making. And it just makes no sense when there is this second. The whole premise of the Supreme Court's construct in Kennedy is missing here. And here there was this second hidden layer of misconduct, and it just doesn't make sense to ask or to hold a defendant to a Hobson's choice where he doesn't actually know what his choices are, and it doesn't make any sense to ask if he was goaded by something he doesn't know. So Mr. McCallum shouldn't be held to his mistrial request, and the retrial should be barred absent manifest necessity, where but for this additional misconduct, such requests wouldn't have been made. Now, the district court didn't reach the factual question of whether counsel would have moved for a mistrial because the court applied the wrong legal standard. The district court did assume below that counsel's judgment was, quote, colored by the government's conduct or misconduct. To the extent fact-finding is needing on this question, the court can remand should remand, but we note that the record does support counsel's representation that she would have pushed ahead. The decision obviously was already really, really close, and these three complaints would have tipped the balance, especially the ES complaint, which was an open complaint at the time. The clock was ticking on the use of that. The court here did not rule out the use of information learned in these complaints, and counsel had every reason to believe she would have been able to make excellent use of them. The court simply didn't even rule at all on the use of reputation or opinion evidence as to the use of it as a prior instance of...
But didn't it later, subsequently, didn't it say these OPC complaints were not admissible?
Well, the complaints themselves were not admissible, but...
But that's all he said.
Well, what he said was, well, it is actually a little confusing, but it is clear that what he's saying is that the government had conceded that with a good faith basis, she could ask, isn't it true that you did X, not referencing any complaint, that you made a false statement about the drugs being found on somebody on a certain date. And on the good faith basis issue, what the court said is that without more, the ES allegations were unproven, and thus far, there wasn't enough to support this reasonable belief, but counsel could have presented the court with the more it needed in the form of credible ES testimony. And likewise, on the pending complaints and the motive to curry favor, the court acknowledged that there was some probative value, but found it slight on the current record because the current record didn't show a credible threat of discipline. And again, the ES testimony could have shown the credible threat of discipline that the court didn't see in the current record. So the court could, and it also could have, frankly, the Crutchfield testimony also, I think you know, would have perhaps the ruling would have changed then as well, because the court looking at this more would have realized
the complaints that were brought to light in February. Do we know when they were actually lodged?
Yeah, there's. I mean,
before the first trial, or
yes, okay. The three complaints. You mean the three that were ultimately revealed? We don't know what the other 14 are. We've never been told that. Okay. We don't know what those are. But as the closed ones, one was filed on December 09. One was June. Oh, I'm sorry. Those okay. are the dates of the.
But they're long before the.
Yeah, the 2010, and then September 2011, shortly before the trial here, was when the ES one was filed. So. In some, I think that the counsel would have felt like that would have been very confident that she was going to be able to make use of it, even if the court at that moment had said, well, if you're going to ask me now, the answer is no. But as these things develop and as proffers are made, I think counsel would have been confident that she was, and she already, things really were going very well, as the district court acknowledged, that, you know, the cross-examination had gone pretty much exactly as she had predicted it would in the opening, if not better. So. In these highly unusual circumstances, the rationale for the going stand simply doesn't apply, and retrial has to be barred absent manifest necessity. And the court should either bar retrial itself or, at a minimum, remand for the district court to make fact-finding under the correct legal standard. No other questions?
I'll give you a couple minutes in reply. All right. Ms. Ament? Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Christina Ament on behalf of the United States. In this case, appellant has offered this court no compelling reason to abandon 30 years of precedent that started with Kennedy, and the district court properly applied the Kennedy standard, A, used the Kennedy standard, and B, properly applied it.
Wait, can you help me understand the Kennedy standard a little bit? So we have this exception for when the prosecutor goads the defense counsel into seeking a mistrial. What's the principle that's vindicating or protecting there? Why that exception?
Well, the principle, Your Honor, is that what the Double Jeopardy Clause seeks to prevent are government-initiated second prosecutions. So we all know, and the Supreme Court has said since Perez, that it doesn't bar all second prosecutions.
Right.
But the ones that it does bar are government-initiated ones. So if the government, in the most extreme case, files the same indictment again after there's been a mistrial or an acquittal. So what the Kennedy standard is saying is if the government does, through misconduct, the equivalent, goads the defense into declaring a mistrial and then says, oh, we're going to try it again, that's barred. And
but what is it about goading the defendant? I mean,
Well, because basically what the Kennedy standard says is that if the government initiates a prosecution, gets it going, and then for whatever reason says, you know what, we don't like what's going on here, mm-hmm. and we want to have another bite at the apple, that's what they can't do.
But isn't part of the problem with goading is that the defense counsel then is seeking a mistrial, but she doesn't have all the information she needs to make an informed choice whether she should seek a verdict or seek a mistrial.
Well, Your Honor, I'd have two.
Isn't it? It's a lack of information, and in that regard, isn't it very similar to the argument that the public defender is raising here?
Well, Your Honor, there are two responses to that. One is no court has ever assumed in the midst of trial that anyone is going to have perfect information about A, everything that's gone on in the background, and B, how a second trial.
No, but what we have here is we have a case where defense counsel doesn't know, the government knows that there's information out there that could be very helpful or potentially very helpful to defense counsel. And defense counsel then seeks a mistrial without having access to that information. And her claim is that she would have made a very different choice if she had known about these complaints against the star witnesses of the government. That
Your
seems...
Honor, what the Kennedy standard says is that if the reason for the mistrial being necessary at all has nothing to do with misconduct on the part of the government, which the district court found there was no willful conduct.
It's not a matter of misconduct, it's a matter of information, right? I mean, isn't the premise behind the Kennedy rule that the defense counsel is making an informed choice. And if the government is sitting on information that would have changed that choice, doesn't that have some bearing on
your analysis? Honor, if the government is sitting on information, but in this case, there was no information being sat on. At the time of the mistrial, there were two audio tapes that had come to light that prompted defense counsel.
Okay, so that's a factual. But as a legal matter, if the hypothetically, if the government were sitting on information that if defense counsel had access to it, one would presume they would want to go to trial because their chances of acquittal are going to be increased. If you had that fact pattern, do you agree that the rule of Kennedy may not reach that far, that the premise of Kennedy is different?
Well, I believe what courts that have been, for example, if the government was suborning perjury and somebody found out later that the government knew full well that they'd put mm-hmm. on a witness that was testifying falsely, at least the Second Circuit has suggested that possibly the Kennedy standard would simply apply to the later consideration of what the government did. So in other words, they would say, you put on a perjurious testimony and you sat on it long enough, and so we might use double jeopardy principles to bar a subsequent retrial. The Second Circuit didn't actually do that, but it mentioned that as a possibility. That's not what defense is arguing here. And what the district court properly did was say, at the time of the mistrial here, the Kennedy standard applies because appellant moved for the mistrial based on what he argued was government misconduct in withholding these audio tapes. And what the trial court, or the district court, said was, no, there was no misconduct on the part of the prosecutor because he didn't know about the audio tapes until they were mentioned on cross-examination. He went out and procured them as quickly as he could. What defense is trying to expand that to is to say, when there was an ongoing process of investigation in progress that the prosecutor had undertaken on behalf of the court to see if there were OPC complaints out here, and he had told the court he was working on that. When we know from defense counsel statements on February 6th that she was aware that not only Mr. McCallum but other people had filed complaints against these officers, because the Public Defender Service had told her, there's no basis for the argument now that defense counsel was simply lacking the information, the requisite information to make a choice on whether to make a mistrial. And even if she was lacking some information, which everybody usually is in the course of a trial, there's no information, there's no evidence on this record that the lack of information came from government misconduct. And that's what the key to Kennedy is what Kennedy says is that it's only when the government forces a mistrial on a defendant by committing misconduct of whatever type that it can be considered a government-instigated second trial.
And that's the answer to my goading question. It's when if the government is the source of withholding the information or keeping the defense from having the information to make the fully informed choice,
Yes, if the government willfully does that. And as the courts have said since Kennedy, it's not enough to be negligent. It's not enough to have conscious avoidance. It's not enough. In this case,
so that's goading. That's the intentional.
Goading is the intentional, willful, either provoking of some bad act at trial or withholding information that the defense would have needed. Okay. In this case, the district court found, and we submit there was no clear error in the finding, that there was no willful conduct, there was no misconduct on the part of the prosecutor at all. What the prosecutor here did was navigate a morass of two different district government agencies to attempt to find these complaints. The reason why he continued to do that after the end of the first trial is because it's a complex process, and he had no way of knowing or verifying. As he said to the court, he couldn't confirm or deny that all the information had been found. And he didn't commit misconduct by continuing to search and find things and give them to the court for review once he became aware of them. But to say that the defense counsel here had no idea there were complaints out here is simply wrong. She'd known about Mr. McCallum's complaint, presumably all along, and the Public Defender Service had informed her of more information than our prosecutor had, that there had been some complaints filed at OPC, whether those were the three that came to light later or different ones, the record isn't clear.
So, counsel, let me go back a second. Did you say conscious avoidance?
The Second Circuit used that word in a case where one of the case agents was arrested in the middle of trial, and they said that the prosecutors had not had been at worst negligent or consciously avoiding trying to find out the nature of how bad the situation with the police officers was that provoked a mistrial, and they didn't rule that was enough to rise to Kennedy-Godin.
That conscious avoidance was not enough, or that did not constitute conscious avoidance?
That was conscious avoidance, and conscious avoidance was not enough. That was in the Milan case.
So all of the purposes of the Double Jeopardy Clause may be served, so long and yet relief denied, so long as it's the incompetence of the cops and not the intention of the prosecutor?
Yes, in fact, I believe that there was one case in U.S. v. Leonard in the Tenth Circuit where the court commented that the prosecutor simply wasn't aware of all the requirements of the Jenks Act, so he committed Jenks Act violations and said, well, that wasn't misconduct, it wasn't intended to go, because he just simply didn't know that he had to turn over things because he was new to the office. So in Milan, it was more than incompetent cops. It was criminal cops and prosecutors who didn't really want to delve into how bad their case was falling apart.
And here we have government departments that are, let's say, at least slipshod in their handling of what might be material.
Your Honor, what we have here is a complicated set of situations because police complaints can go to two different sources. They can go to the OPC, which is an independent statutorily created agency in the district government. Then there's the Metropolitan Police Department, which for Jenks purposes is looked at as part of the government prosecution team. What happened here was that the prosecutor attempted to go through channels at both MPD and OPC to find out whether there were complaints. But in fact, what the prosecutor probably should have done was to suggest to the district court, when the district court ordered him to find out about these complaints, to suggest that defense counsel issue a subpoena to OPC, because OPC is not statutorily obligated to give over this documentation to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So in this case, they did it, but they did it rather slowly. And they did it more as a favor than as anything that was required.
But this comes in a context where this is the fourth or fifth episode out of five, I believe, in which the government has failed to turn over information, including information sitting on the prosecutor's desk that defense counsel happened to notice. Now, let me ask you this. At some point, does repetition of that kind of omission is not sufficient to say that the prosecutor is beyond even conscious avoidance? The prosecutor is a party to this withholding. I mean, think of it this way. Think of the New York Times standard, okay, for a totally different purpose, where you have a knowledge of the falsity of a published statement, or reckless disregard for whether it's true. Well, you can see a parallel here, right? Knowledge that there's information being withheld, or the irresistible implication after time after time after time after time that I better make sure there isn't more information being withheld.
Well, Your Honor, what I would say is that I understand the court's concern, and I can conceive of a situation where a district court, having sat through all the proceedings in the case, might conclude that the government was doing some sort of impermissible withholding. Here, the district court never made any such finding. The district court found that the instances of withholding in this case were not willful. And the district court is in the best position, a better position than me, a better position than appellate counsel.
But that's like saying that the court found that there wasn't actual knowledge of the falsity of something, right? Still leaves open the question, should the district court have asked whether there wasn't a sufficient alternative interpretation here, a parallel ground for relief?
And what I would also say, Your Honor, is that if the concern is things like a document being left on the desk, what the Kennedy standard tells us is that the district court needs to ask two things. One, and which is what the court's focusing on right here, is the nature of the prosecutor's action. Did the prosecutor commit misconduct? But as the Supreme Court said in Kennedy, it's also an intent standard. What was the government's intent in doing this? And if the government's intent in doing that was either to win or was just to make life difficult for the defense counsel, anything like that, there are other sanctions than double jeopardy bars that address those. It's only where the intention is to goad the defendant into seeking a mistrial that Kennedy would require such a thing.
The finding by the district court with regard to the lack of intention preceded the last of these episodes, didn't it?
No, Your Honor, because the trial court made a finding following the March 21st argument. I can't remember the date of its actual order denying the double jeopardy motion.
So were there two separate findings then at different times?
No, Your Honor. What the trial court found was that there was no willful conduct ever on the part of, I believe that the district court says that the prosecutor's instances were unfortunate and unintended, and then goes on to say that there was no willful conduct at all and that there was no goading and no intent to goad. And he says all those in the final order and also refused to the defense motion to strike the officer's testimony earlier on when they tried that in alternative to a mistrial.
Are there any more questions? All right, Ms. Emmett, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We would ask that the order of the district court be affirmed.
All right, thanks. Let's see, Ms. Wright, why don't you take 2 minutes? All right.
I want to say, back to the point on which I blanked out, that I want to be very clear. Counsel understood there was nothing else, and counsel certainly didn't have any information about these three complaints that turned out to be, in the court's view, producible. And if it comes down to what counsel understood or didn't understand about the outstanding materials on the subpoena and the status of that, there should be a remand, frankly, for testimony about the conversations between counsel and such things that aren't in the record. But if that's what this is going to come down to, then we would certainly ask for that, because it's our view she had no way of knowing. And I'd just like to point to the objective circumstances that back that up, which is that when on 4 days before the mistrial request, the prosecutor said that the day before he had been given material from IAD, and MPD counsel had told him that that material should include the OPC complaints. Knowing how concerned the court was that everything be found, he did make the caveat that she had not actually spoken to OPC, and he said, this morning I spoke to OPC. This is day four before the mistrial. I spoke to OPC. I got the name of the contact person. I wasn't able to speak to him, but I gave his name to MPD counsel. This is the morning of 4 days before. So at that point, he's also in contact throughout with the officers and can simply ask them. You know, they know if there's complaints outstanding against them. The idea that he can't find out that there's something more or track this down when he has the name of the right person. And the key thing I also want to say is that this was the whole purpose of getting this. The subpoena was for cross-examination. Cross-examination began and ended on Monday the 19th. So once that's over, there, obviously counsel has every reason to believe, you wouldn't think, well, the prosecutor has simply blown off the court's directive and has chosen instead to simply, you know, not confirm or deny the existence of this. And on the issue of the misconduct, it is important, I think, that what he knew was that he knew he hadn't complied with the court's directive, even though he subjectively, quote, suspected that there was more stuff. And said nothing. And that is what caused this case to be unique and different in the sense that the defense was not able to make their Hobson's choice in any sort of knowing fashion. And we would ask the court to either bar retrial or remand for fact-finding on any facts that the court considers important to that decision.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.